subject of birth control and related issues, what does the Bible have to say about the subject of birth control? This is a big discussion, but I think it can be clarified if we just keep two polar stars from the Bible in mind. And I'm not going to mess with the screen and curtains and all that, but we could just have a mental image of a blackboard here. The two points to keep in mind about this, number one, the value of human life as God views it. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. God cares about human life. He prepared for it. He brought it to pass. He has a purpose for it. And then the second point is the sacredness of the family as God views it. By family, I'm referring to the nuclear family, marriage and parenthood, as God views that. If we can keep what the Bible says about these two issues, human life in general, and then the family in particular, what God says about those have a great bearing on a number of related issues. Now, there are a lot of methods of contraception that are available to people in our country at this time. But in the Bible times, undoubtedly the most universal and commonly practiced method of averting conception was coitus interruptus, or the withdrawal method as it's usually called. There are a number of lines of evidence for that, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on those, but there were various terms for the temple prostitutes that were used in the pagan societies that indicate types of contraception that were used. The Talmud of the Jews indicates that withdrawal was practiced to avoid pregnancy during the 24 months when a child was nursed. And also we have the case of Onan in the 38th chapter of the book of Genesis. Genesis 38 verses 8 through 10 is the one clear example of withdrawal for contraceptive intentions in the Old Testament. And the context, much has been made of the case of Onan, but the context there, I believe, clearly indicates that Onan's sin lay in his selfish unwillingness to honor his levirate marriage duty by raising up seed to his dead brother's name. Jesus talked about this responsibility in the 17th chapter of the book of Matthew when he was in this conversation with the Sadducees. They were talking about this. Onan had the responsibility under the levirate system of not only marrying his brother's widow, but raising up seed to his dead brother's name through this widow. In Onan's case, he was willing to marry his brother's widow, but then he perverted the institution by the withdrawal process. And I believe this passage instructs us concerning the responsible use of sexuality, but I can't see that it forbids contraception per se. In the light of the fact that all through Bible times, contraception was practiced by withdrawal, we would expect to find a prohibition of the practice in the Bible if God considered it to be a sinful act. And we don't find anything like that. There are two passages in particular where we would expect to find that if it was going to be included. And they're both in the book of Leviticus. In Leviticus chapter 15, verses 16 through 18, we see that the emission of semen apart from intercourse was not regarded as a sinful act. No sacrifice was required for it. There was no moral fault that it was implied in it. The laws about it were ceremonial and sanitary, but there was nothing morally wrong there. It seems to be indicated in Leviticus 15 and 16 through 18. And then again in Leviticus 20, verses 10 through 21, we have a list of sexual crimes which are punishable by death. All of them involved intercourse with a person or an animal apart from marriage, but there was no reference to withdrawal as a sexual sin. Now, before I go any farther talking about birth control, I need to talk about a couple of extreme views of marriage. One is marriage as a means to an end, and the other is marriage as an end in itself. I say both of these are extremes because I think the Bible view of marriage is in the middle. But I want to talk about the extremes first. Marriage as a means to an end means that it's not of value as an end in itself. This view says that the primary purpose of marriage is the generation and the rearing of children. The Church of Rome, which had a lot of attention drawn to it this week, generally has taken that position, that this is one of the very principal purposes of marriage and of sexuality, and if you're not trying to engender children, then you shouldn't be having sexuality, seems to be the idea there. All other aspects of the marriage relationship must be viewed as just contributory to the procreative process and purpose. This view makes every effort to discourage birth control, and limitations on childbearing are permitted only by the so-called natural rhythm method. But the limitations are regarded as exceptions applicable in cases of ill health and disease and poverty, etc. Contrary to this point of view of marriage as a means to an end, there's also the idea of marriage as an end in itself, the rise of the very different philosophy of marriage in relatively modern times. This view, nourished by the courtly love tradition of the medieval period and the romantic movement of the 19th century, sees the union of a man and a woman not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. The attitude toward birth control that arises from this view is easily predictable, and Planned Parenthood is propagating that idea today. The question, though, to us who are in Christ and follow the Bible is, how does the Bible view birth control? I think we answer that by asking, how does the Bible view marriage? The central focus of scriptural teaching on marriage is not found in just the first two chapters of Genesis, where we have the story of Adam and Eve, but the premier passage on marriage in the New Testament is Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 through 32, where, interestingly, children are not even mentioned. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. You know the passage well. Children are not even mentioned in that passage. And it quotes the book of Genesis in the context of the New Covenant. Understood in the light of New Testament fulfillment, marriage cannot be regarded simply as a means to an end, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, but it can't be regarded just as an end in itself either. They shall be one flesh. Rather, marriage is seen as an analogy in the Bible. In fact, it's represented as the best human analogy of the relationship between Christ and his church. Paul connects husband and wife with Christ and the church with three as's and two just as's in those 10 verses in Ephesians chapter 5. And then he concludes with the great summary statement, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." When and only when marriage is viewed as a type of which Christ and the church are the antitype or the fulfillment, can we avoid both the extremes of marriage as a means to an end and marriage as an end in itself. I said all that to say this. Christ's relationship with the church is a total love relationship, not just a means to an end. So we must not view marriage simply as a procreative function and nothing more. Therefore, when contraception can contribute to subduing the earth in order to achieve a better total human relationship, I don't see how it can be condemned from the Bible. And yet, neither is the human love relationship an end in itself. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Why? Because in the next world, that which is in part shall be done away. This is a principle of life. In the full manifestation of the antitype in the next world, the type is embraced and disappears. Thus, the love relationship between husband and wife must never be absolutized as though it's just an end in itself. A husband and wife must never make the mistake of living merely for each other, because they must both be for the Lord. This relationship is only meaningful insofar as it reflects the Christ relationship. And apart from that, it can even become idolatrous. In the light of the divine analogy of marriage, we can see the centrality of children to the marital union. Jesus didn't give himself up for death as just an isolated deed, but he did it to bring many sons unto glory. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. As the union between Christ and his church does not exist for its own sake, but to bring other people to spiritual rebirth, so the marital union is properly fulfilled in natural birth. So how, on a practical level, is a Christian young couple, and somebody may ask you about this, so it needs to be thought through so you can give an answer. How is a Christian young couple to decide the birth control issue for themselves? We do it within the framework of the analogy relationship. They have to consider this personally and prayerfully in the light of their own situation, physically, emotionally, financially, and spiritually, and also in the light of the population picture in their area of the world. The answer might not always be the same for Christians in India as it would be for Christians in Canada. But they have to act responsibly, viewing marriage neither as a means or an end, but as the great analogy of Jesus Christ's work of salvation. I don't encourage young childless couples who don't want children to have children. But I do encourage young childless couples who don't want children to want children. I think the Apostle Paul encouraged that. I will, therefore, that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, as a general rule. 1 Timothy chapter 5. What we can do to make our marriages evangelistic can happen both generatively and regeneratively. So I believe the responsible use of birth control is acceptable to God. But I'm talking here about contraception. Whatever prevents the fertilization of the egg is acceptable in some cases. On the other hand, whatever interrupts a pregnancy after the egg is fertilized, I believe is ending a life already begun, and that's in a different category. The so-called morning after pill, RU486, methotrexate, is in that category. We have invented a new language that blurs the line between contraception and abortion there. With the IUD as a contraceptive device, I think we have the same problem, or can have the same problem, of purposefully ending pregnancies after they have already begun. I believe whatever results in the intentional death of an embryonic human life is wrong. James said in James chapter 2 that the body without the spirit is dead. We know that a fertilized egg is not dead. If it was dead, then nobody would be thinking of it as a problem. The body without the spirit is dead. The fertilized egg is not dead. It's got 46 chromosomes right in that little zygote, that fertilized egg. 23 from the sperm, 23 from the egg. They're all there already. If it's not a living human already, then what is it? And if it's not alive, just leave it alone and it'll never be a problem. But if the body without the spirit is dead and this body is not dead, then it seems to me to have a human spirit already. In the first chapter of the book of Genesis, we find a special word, the word translated into English as create, that only occurs three times in Genesis 1. It occurs in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It occurs again in verse 21 and then again in verse 27. Whereas the word make, which is a different word with a different meaning, is used in verse 7, 16, 25, and 31. But when the special word create is used, there's a ramping up, an amplification of God's world that occurs every time. In verse 1, he's talking about the physical elements. In verse 21, he's talking about animal life. And then in verse 27, he's talking about spiritual life, human life with the spiritual implications to it. And it's the spiritual difference that makes man man as different from the animals. This is the spiritual difference that's referenced in chapter 9. That it was sinful to murder a man. It was not sinful to kill animals. You can use them for food, Noah was told when he came out of the ark. But it was sinful to kill an ark, a person, a human being. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God created he man. Human life is God-given, sacred, and is to be treasured and protected. The same time in our country in the past few decades, at the same time that we were relaxing the death penalty on hardened criminals, we were also putting that penalty onto babies, unborn babies, whose only crime was being unexpected and unwanted and unloved, killing them through techniques that are crueler than I want to describe to you. We've been taught that we're animals, and so now we're starting to act like that. And it's the murder of the helpless as far as I'm concerned. In Proverbs chapter 6, one of the things that the Lord hates is hands that shed innocent blood. And the baby develops a vascular system after 3 weeks, 3 weeks after fertilization, that produces blood. Before the mother even knows she's pregnant, her baby has a vascular system in place in most cases. We've come to the place in America that our senses have been stripped and we've lost our moorings and we're no longer able to even blush about it and we're adrift in a sea of relativism. The Bible makes a number of comments about unborn human beings. Comments like this: Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. Before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. That was said to Jeremiah about how God viewed him before he was even born. Would it have been sinful for Jeremiah's mother to have aborted him? Well, she would have been aborting a baby that God already knew and had made a prediction about. In the first chapter of the Galatian letter, the same thing is said about the Apostle Paul, that he was separated from his mother's womb. And this is said a number of times in the Bible. Would it have been sinful for Jesus' mother, Mary, to have gotten an abortion and aborted Jesus? She wasn't married, but it certainly would have been wrong for her to do that. In the first chapter of Luke, John the Baptist, as an unborn child, seems to have a personality, and God knows what's going on with him. The 139th Psalm says in verse 16, that thine eyes did see my substance when as yet there was none of them. I was microscopic, God, but you understood how you were knitting me together in the womb. In the third chapter of the book of Job, verse 11, a miscarriage is in a category with other people who had died. And we can see this over and over again. I'm not sort of preaching to the choir here in a way, maybe, but so I'm not going to emphasize that point anymore. But it is a point that deserves our attention. God has a plan for a human life. Abortion destroys God's work. If we're supposed to do all in the name of the Lord, how can an abortionist do all in the name of the Lord as he's scraping God's creation out and flushing it down the sink? I don't consider abortion as an acceptable alternative. The church can be a big help to somebody who has a baby and is not prepared to raise it. There are a number of people, and I can point you in the direction of people if this becomes an issue, of people who would love to have a baby but have been unable to have one. So we must always teach against murder when it's appropriate. And we have every reason to believe that abortion is that. So whenever this becomes an issue, we must find acceptable alternatives to it and have faith in God. But I'd like to go a step further beyond just the idea of birth control and contraception and abortion. What about artificial insemination? This has been used a great deal in the past few decades and is still being used at a rapid rate. When a husband's sperm is collected and then inserted in a large quantity into the womb of the wife, this is done usually with a 20% or less success rate, but it is often done. The reason for this, usually between a husband and wife, is male infertility that's caused by a combination of problems, not just a lack of concentration of sperm. So that's the reason that it doesn't work any better than it does. But more widespread and much more controversial is artificial insemination using the sperm of a donor, an anonymous donor. And it's estimated that well over 1 million people now have been conceived by this method. Lots of lesbians are using this in our time, proud to have a child without a man, just through artificial insemination by the use of an anonymous donor. Several studies have indicated that this can be very harmful to the family. In some cases, the wife becomes obsessed with curiosity about the donor, wanting to find out his identity and get to know him. Very few couples repeat this kind of a birth using artificial insemination with a donor sperm. Most of the children don't know that they were born through this process. Psychologists in general want to keep it that way. The identity problem such a child might have can be enormous and possibly devastating. So the parents are forced in many cases to live with a secret that they can never openly discuss with their child. There's a conspiracy of silence that always strains relationships. There's a slight risk that half-brothers, and the more of this is that it's done, the bigger the risk will be, that half-brothers and half-sisters that are conceived by this method might marry each other. As far back as 1974, a doctor had to intervene to keep a marriage like that from happening. A young man and young woman were getting ready to get married and didn't realize that they were half-siblings because of this process that we're describing. The legal nightmares that come about from this are almost incalculable. We've been through a lot of these already in a number of different states. and talking about what is legitimacy, and it's just a big headache. There have been divorces. Husbands have filed for divorce on the basis that the doctor who performed this artificial insemination using donor sperm had technically committed adultery with the wife because of the process that was used, and refused to pay child support because they said that that's not my child. So we have to face this issue if we continue to use this process of who is the actual and legitimate father if donor sperm is used. I believe that artificial insemination using only the sperm of the husband would be morally right. I look at that as a mere technological crutch. If we go beyond that, I think we're in serious trouble biblically. I believe artificial insemination using donor sperm is a violation of the marriage relationship as we find it in the Bible, and it's a violation of the biblical meaning of parenthood. If the donor were an identical twin, I still would think that this is wrong. An identical twin with the exact same genes as the husband, I still think this is wrong. The marriage union would still be violated because of it, because the marriage union exists between two individuals, not just two sets of chromosomes. What about the concept of test tube babies, or in vitro fertilization, as we call it? In vitro fertilization, generally as it's been practiced through the years, many eggs are taken from a woman's ovary and fertilized at the same time. One of these eggs, then, is selected for implantation, and the others are washed down the drain. Here we have human life created in order to be destroyed. The only way I could even consider in vitro fertilization would be if we just fertilize one egg of the wife with her husband's sperm, and then place it in the mother to be brought to term. I could see that, because that keeps in consonance with the biblical principles. But as it stands, each child born by in vitro fertilization as a test tube baby represents a dozen or more siblings that have just been washed down the drain. And to me, that's an unconscionable thing. What about surrogate mothers? This gets a lot of conversation in our time, because it's possible to mix egg and sperm from any two people and put the fertilized embryo into any normal womb, and thus have any final set of parents or any single person gain custody of the newborn baby. Here we have parenthood having nothing to do with biological relationship. We have the child ceasing to be a gift from God and becoming a commercial item. And we have parents as consumers, looking through catalogs, what do you want your baby to look like? And, well, here we can give you donor sperm that will cause your baby to have these kinds of chromosomes and so forth. A baby becomes a commercial item, and the parents as consumers choosing donors from photographs of attractive young men and women. Childbearing was never intended to be just an end within itself, but it's always in the Bible part of a larger plan. Parental responsibility begins at conception and does not end until the child is raised. A great part of that rearing of the child is training that child for the service of God. How can I, as a Christian, surrender my reproductive powers to another person, thus ignoring the responsibilities that are connected with my reproductive powers? If I donate to a sperm bank, then as I walk down the street a few years after that, I don't know if the people I'm meeting are my children or not. I have no way to know this. How could I do that? And how could I ask a Christian, or how could a Christian ask somebody else to premeditatedly do the same thing? Therefore, I believe that maternal surrogacy is against the will of God and strikes at the very heart of God's plan for the home and should be avoided and opposed. When our children were growing up, they had a book called, it was a book about a little bird who hatches while his mother is away from the nest and then stands up out of the egg looking around looking for its mother. And the name of the book was, Are You My Mother? And the little baby bird goes over to the kitten and says, Are you my mother? Goes to the hen and the dog and the cow and says, Are you my mother? Goes to the car and the plane and the steam shovel and says, Are you my mother? Totally baffled as to who its mothers may be. What is the answer to that question, Are you my mother? When today's children answer that, Is the mother the egg donor? Is the mother the womb owner? Is the mother the woman who is married to the father? Just who is the mother in some of these situations? The idea of surrogacy did not work for Abraham and Sarah, even though Sarah thought it was a good idea at the time, and Abraham went right along with it, but it didn't work out for them at all. It only caused turmoil within the family, even though it seemed like a good idea at the time, and I don't think it's a good idea today either. Woodrow Wilson wanted to make the world safe for democracy, and many today want to make the world safe for fornication. And that's what's behind a great deal of what we're talking about here. We don't need another Adolf Hitler to defame human dignity. All that takes is the promise of sexual pleasure without responsibility. And a lot of people are ready to murder millions of babies a year via abortion, many more than that worldwide. All it takes is the promise of a financially secure retirement, and many people are ready to give grandpa and grandma an easy death via euthanasia. Just kill them when you don't want them around anymore. All it takes is the promise of just a few dollars in your pocket, ready cash, and many men are ready to donate their procreative powers to a sperm bank. All it takes is the promise of a perfect child. And some are willing to wash human zygotes down the drain after the fittest one is implanted into the uterus. All it takes for some women to rent their wombs in order to bear somebody else's child is the right price. So we don't require another Adolf Hitler to commit atrocities. These atrocities are going on around us in the world. And the response of the Lord's church to these issues is the same as our response to other moral issues and social issues, and that is to preach the word. Keep pointing people back to what the Bible actually says. The mission of the church is ultimately not one of social reform, but of spiritual reform. If we get the spiritual reform right, then the social things are more likely to take care of themselves. Our mission is educational, not activist. So we use our time and energies actively teaching God's revealed knowledge for mankind, not trying to pass laws to force people to live in a certain way. You and I are genuinely concerned about the way our society is going, but our message from the Bible stresses individual personal responsibility. Change, in order to be sincere and in order to be effective, has to be based on personal conviction. So we help individuals to change their own lives one by one, and society is automatically benefited by that influence. Spiritual regeneration secondarily results in social reformation. The church was never given the charge to reform Roman society in the first centuries. As the church proclaimed the message of Christ, though, hearts were swayed by the power of the gospel, and social reforms followed as an indirect result of that. In the third chapter of the book of James, verse 9, the statement there is a reminder of what Moses said of man. And it's still true that he's made in the image of God. Man is made in the image of God and therefore possesses an intrinsic value. Every person around us came about as a result of this process that God designed and has great value, whether they themselves even realize it or not. And while it's certainly true that there are many numerous physical aspects to marriage and the home, the ultimate thrust of the home is a spiritual thrust, and it's an earthly arrangement to enhance our heavenward journey. So we need to make decisions that we know that God will be pleased with. That's my view on birth control and these other issues from the Bible. We're going to conclude this afternoon by letting you think about that and also extending an invitation. If anybody is subject to the invitation in any way, let us know how we can assist you as we once more stand, and Denny's going to lead Come to Jesus.